The news is not in the business of informing you. If they were in the business of informing people, people would then become informed and then they wouldn't watch the news anymore. So it's realizing that the business of the news is to get you to continue watching the news. Like, your phone's job is not to solve your problems. Your phone is to become the ongoing way of managing your problems, right? In the way that, like, methadone isn't supposed to get you off of heroin, it's supposed to get you on to methadone. So realizing that the job of the news is to always be developing, always be breaking, but never actually get to the final conclusion where you are informed was really helpful to me, because then I go, oh, okay, I'm not going to follow the news to know what's happening. I'm going to look actually backwards towards history, and I'm not going to let the news rile me up or make me think the world is ending or ruin my day. I'm going to decide where I get my information and why.
That is best-selling author, founder of the company Brass Check, and marketing guru, Ryan Holiday. And this is episode 311 of Better Than Yesterday. Hello and welcome to Better Than Yesterday. I'm Osher Ginsberg. This is episode 311 of the show with author, marketing guru, founder of the company Brass Check, swimmer, farmer, father, Ryan Holiday. You can find Ryan online. He's at Twitter and Instagram at Ryan Holiday, R-Y-A-N, Holiday, and ryanholiday.net. More about Ryan and a check. In a tick. If you're new, g'day, welcome. I'm Osher Ginsberg. I'm a TV, radio, podcast, book guy from Sydney, Australia. And this podcast is simply a conversation designed to help you make today a bit better than yesterday. No matter what, in the next hour and a bit, you'll hear something that'll make you think, oh, I never considered that. And as a result, today, a little bit better than yesterday. That's it. That's all we're here to do. Thank you very much to all and sundry who reached out during the week to check on me. Thank you so, so much. I really appreciate it. I can't tell you how grateful I am that you did so, including the very good people at the Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal, who actually said that a bunch of new donations came in this week that cited this very podcast when you ticked the box, how'd you hear about them? So if the fact that most of the east coast of Australia is on fire and you don't know what to do is bothering you, you can go to frrr.org.au. FRRR, three R's, FRRR.org.au. Yeah, I don't know how to protect our inland communities from climate change, but they know a lot more about it than I do, and they need our help right now. A big thanks to everyone that emailed through the week, sendosheremail@gmail.com. It's great to hear from you. Great to see where you're listening to the show as well. I love the pictures that you send me. Just shoot a photo of what you're looking at and send it to me, sendosheremail@gmail.com. Thanks very much to Selvin, who just wanted to say your podcasts have been super helpful for me, especially your check-ins. My wife and I recently had our first baby. Congratulations. And while I was settling baby yesterday, for the first time I played your check-in for both my wife and baby. She only knows you from Bachelor. She says become a fan of yours and started following you on Instagram. Good timing with Wolfgang and your dad podcast. Really wanted to say thanks for all you do and sharing your anxiety struggles. Helped immensely. Thanks, mate. Oh, that's super kind of you. Thank you so much. Great one from Luke, our mate Luke in the Central West. Listening to your check-in, sorry to hear the weather events have set you off a bit. I thought I could set, he calls them his, set off your fears. He calls them spidey senses. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. I thought I could send you a cheer up as I was feeding my sheep. I laughed when I saw what they did to a bale of hay. It's quite a sculpture. I think this angle shows off the symmetry best. Just heard you having Ryan Holiday on the Monday show. He wrote a great book on stoicism. Yes, he did. And Luke has sent this great picture of what a bale of hay looks like after a bunch of sheep have been at it. And they've essentially, it looks like it's carved into something that you'd see in the Moab Desert down in Utah or something in a Roadrunner cartoon. It's pretty rad. They've actually eaten the bottom right off of it and then left this table top. One came in from Bridget, who sent a view in. This is a view from my veranda. She's in Wauchope in New South Wales. I wish this view in the photograph was missed. Unfortunately, it's smoke from the hundreds of fire that are surrounding our little town right now. I live about 200 metres from the Area Command Centre. Hundreds of heroes protecting us. Family and friends have been directly affected by these fires with lots of loss of property. We've been told this is the new normal for our area. It's frightening when burning leaves are falling around our 130-year-old historic home. We must learn to be resilient in these times, and I'm always reminding myself of the wonderful things in my life and learn to accept these conditions. Hopefully the next picture will be more cheerful. Thanks for your hard work and understanding. Crikey. Whew. And to round off, a great one came in from Isaac. Is riding a bicycle through the country, and he sent me a check-in podsy of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 massive wind turbines. And he then I emailed back and said, mate, I really needed to see that. Thanks very much. And then the next photo he sent me is like he's climbed up one of them because he works in the wind industry. And it's a view across the beautiful landscape of these incredible wind turbines atop a hill. Keep your head up and keep doing what you're doing. Thanks very much, man. I really appreciate you sending that through. Very, very much. A huge thanks to those who listened to the Bo Ryan episode. If you haven't heard it, it was on last week. It was a really important conversation to have. I'm really grateful that he and I got to have it together. As always, if you want to help this show, you can rate, you can review, you subscribe wherever you can rate, review, and subscribe to this show. And just recommend it to other people. Just tell other people to listen to it. That's the best thing you can do for us.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So let me tell you about my guest today. Ryan Holiday is an author, marketing genius, founder of the consultancy company Brass Check, father, farmer, swimmer, tattoo aficionado, and he's based in Austin, Texas. Though I didn't know it at the time, I first became aware of his work when he was in charge of marketing for the now largely defunct but hugely influential American clothing brand, American Apparel. And it was later when I read his brilliant book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator, that he came to reveal exactly how he pulled off the things he pulled off while he worked for American Apparel, and indeed then how easily it was to manipulate the media. It was then that I gained a scope of how easily what we see and hear and then feel and then decide upon can be so easily dictated to us by outside sources under the guise of legitimate news. Ryan has had a long fascination with Stoic philosophy, and his best-selling books, The Obstacle is the Way, Ego is the Enemy, and the new number one New York Times best-selling book, Stillness is the Key, most definitely opened me up to a different way of thinking about the world, and a world that I often struggle with, as you are no doubt aware. Via his daily updates on the Daily Stoic and Daily Stoic, and now his excellent daily fatherhood email, which I love, The Daily Dad, Ryan is a prolific writer and thinker, someone who's wise beyond his years and a person that I definitely aspire to emulate when it comes to a calm way of observing the world. This particular podcast, this conversation has been years in the making. So I really have to thank two really important people in my life, both US serial entrepreneur Manish Sethi and the Australian entrepreneur and author Pete Williams, for forming a two-pronged connection when it came to looping me into Ryan's orbit that allowed me to get onto his radar and certainly back on his radar around the release of this new book. So, gentlemen, thank you so much. We made it happen. If you've never heard of Ryan Holiday before, strap in. His wisdom and his depth of knowledge is simply staggering. His way of speaking and constructing a rational view of reality devoid of emotional distortion is something to truly behold. And there's a great freedom in the way he goes about the world. I couldn't be more grateful for his time to dive in real deep on what Ryan is all about, ryanholiday.net or at Ryan Holiday on Twitter and Instagram. The new book is called Stillness is the Key. It is a cracking read. So without further ado, please welcome over the internet from Austin, Texas, Ryan Holiday. Hey, Ryan, how you going, man?
Doing excellent. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. It's great to finally talk to you.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you too.
Honestly, the other week I was very jealous when I heard that you were running with Rich, because when I lived in LA, I used to go running with Rich a bit, and I do miss that.
Oh, he's the best, man. He's the best.
A couple of hours with him and you're like, I mean, honestly, like, he does go slow for you, which is nice.
Yeah, I thought I was going to get destroyed, but he was thankfully quite accommodating.
I think he likes to, when he just goes, I'll just put this in a I'll just make this a recovery run.
Yeah, that's great.
He's on his epic thing, mate. I'm stoked to talk to you. I've been a fan of your work since Trust Me, I'm Lying: Confessions of a Media Manipulator, and I'm really grateful that I read that book early enough to start looking at the media news cycle in a different way, and it really did allow me to see the news, particularly political news, for what it is more and more, and to then go on to digest things like Brexit and the 2016 US election with a bit more clarity. And, you know, before we get into Stillness, which is the new book and the brilliant stuff around the dad, Daily Dad, which I love, when you think about what you learned about and how malleable the media landscape was when you wrote that book to what it's become now, and indeed as we head to the 2020 election in the USA, when you think about where it was, what it's become, and where it's going, what do you think?
Well, one of the things I take from it that's been quite freeing is that the news is not in the business of informing you. If they were in the business of informing people, people would then become informed and then they wouldn't watch the news anymore. So it's realizing that the business of the news is to get you to continue watching the news. Like, your phone's job is not to solve your problems. Your phone is to become the ongoing way of managing your problems, right? In the way that, like, methadone isn't supposed to get you off of heroin, it's supposed to get you on to methadone. So realizing that the job of the news is to always be developing, always be breaking, but never actually get to the final conclusion where you are informed was really helpful to me, because then I go, oh, okay, I'm not going to follow the news to know what's happening. I'm going to look actually backwards towards history, and I'm not going to let the news rile me up or make me think the world is ending or ruin my day, and that I'm going to be very intentional about the news that I consume and why I'm consuming it and all of that. So I think on the one hand, it's sort of disillusioning. You go, oh, the Fourth Estate isn't this wonderful, pure, you know, selfless institution. The Fourth Estate is actually a multi-billion-dollar industry with a lot of people trying to make names for themselves. That's a little disillusioning, but the empowering part is realizing, like, oh, okay, I don't have to be dependent on this thing. I don't have to let it ruin my life. I don't have to let it consume my life. I'm going to decide where I get my information and why.
Okay, so two things there. Firstly, when you say you look back on history, when you do look back on history, what does that tell you about the coming months and years ahead?
I think someone who's grounded in history, in a weird way, it turns down the volume on a lot of the stuff that doesn't matter right now, and then it turns up the volume on a lot of the really alarming stuff that is happening, right? So, like, when I don't get that upset that, you know, Donald Trump tweeted this or that. I'm trying to be as unpolitical about this as possible. I just mean, like, when you look at it you go, wow, this guy has like talked a lot of things and promised a lot of things, but essentially accomplished nothing. Like his legislative accomplishments are very minimal. In a weird way, that's what actually alarms me, that here's this guy who gets elected with two, you know, a majority in both houses on an agenda that a lot of people agree with, and he actually manages to accomplish like nothing. When I look back at like a, you know, a republic like Rome, what brings Julius Caesar to power is not simply that he had this, you know, sort of lust and greed to be in control. What allowed him to realize those two things was that Rome didn't seem to be working. The old way that other people were trying to preserve, as right as they were, was stymied and stuck. And so when I see where we are now, I don't go like, oh, Donald Trump is Julius Caesar. I think more, if this system doesn't get unstuck, if we're not able to come up with real solutions to a lot of the problems that we face that Donald Trump is kind of a symptom of, somebody even worse than him is going to come along and actually be a lot more competent or controlled and adept, and we're going to be in real trouble.
It's interesting that you talk about that, because, you know, when you look at, and as impartial as I can be, you talk of Trump being a symptom of a system that isn't working very well. One could argue that this similar system was allowed someone like Reagan to do what he did for 8 years and essentially just forget things and have Nancy go, we're doing what we can. Like, there's press conferences of Reagan is going, we're doing what we can. There's an answer to every question, because he couldn't actually, he would tell war stories that he saw in movies as if they were real, you know.
Sure.
But we're still the president and things were going along just fine. And the idea, as you just mentioned, that someone could be then put into that position who is, as you say, far more confident, like as charismatic as Obama, but not a nice human in his heart, we're ripe for that.
It's been a weird thing with some of my books, but my books have sort of made their way through American politics. And so every once in a while, I'll go to Washington, D.C., and I'll have, you know, breakfast or lunch with someone. And I was having breakfast with a pretty well-known senator, and probably not known internationally, but definitely one of the better known American senators. And he was like, look, like if Trump knew what he was doing, I think he and his family could rule this country for the next 20 years. Like he was saying this as an alarmed thing, like not that he wanted this to happen, but the point was like things are so fractured and so stuck in a way. And again, we could talk about this all day, but the Trump's ego in a weird way has been the ultimate check and balance. Like he's sort of actually not able to figure out how the system works and use it to his advantage. He's very good at the marketing and controlling the messaging and sucking all the attention out of the media system for himself. But the actual nuts and bolts of legislation and the levers of power, that in the way that someone like a Lyndon Johnson or an FDR was able to realize a good chunk of their agenda. Again, you can totally disagree with their agenda, it's hard to argue that they were not able to realize a lot of it, which is all to say that when you study these things historically, you're able to not get as distracted by the sort of day-to-day developments of, oh, did someone say this, or, you know, did this piece of information come out? And you're able to go like, okay, there's a fascinating book I read called Tyrant, which is by Steven Greenblatt. And he was looking at the Shakespearean villains of all of Shakespeare's plays. And when you read a book like that, you're able to sort of make connections to the different personality types of our time. And you're reading it through the insights of someone who obviously was not alive for any of this.
Yeah.
But human beings are human beings, and we've kind of always done the same things.
Yeah. So one more thing, then we'll get to it. So when you say the system is broken, the system is failing, through your look at history and you look at various, you know, ways that humans have figured out how to govern massive amounts of people, what would need to change, or what's a change that you think would take us in a more positive direction?
I think what people misunderstand about the American system is that we think it's sort of three equal branches, and it's not really supposed to be three equal branches. It's three very different branches of government that operate each with their own function. And so in my opinion, the Congress is supposed to legislate, to pass and create the laws. The president is supposed to execute those laws, and the judiciary is supposed to check those laws against constitutionality and some other legalistic concerns. But right now, the legislative body in America essentially passes almost no laws and takes almost no active role in solving the problems that the country faces, whether it's economic or international or immigration.
Yeah.
So like what you're seeing is the president deciding to sign executive orders to address these big crises,
right,
which Congress should be doing. And then you see those things, because they're controversial and there's not necessarily a majority behind them, you see those things go to the courts, which then become super politicized. So instead of gay marriage being a law passed either in each individual state or at the federal level, what's happening is these things are being fought in the courts and with these narrow majorities.
Yeah.
And so basically everyone's upset. The legislative function in the United States is that nobody ever has a majority, and to pass things you need a majority. So it's supposed to create incentives for compromise and sort of pretty good, you know, things that satisfy both parties. And instead we've started to think that it's like you elect the president for your side, and then he forces things down the throat of everyone who's on the other side, and then you've stacked the court, and then the court backs you up. And it's like, no, you're supposed to elect representatives. Those representatives are supposed to get together, pass laws that solve the problems. The president executes the laws, and then the court is a check against both of those two other branches. And then the media is supposed to be the one effectively communicating and reminding and clarifying all of this. And basically, of the four sides, none of them are doing their job properly. And so that when I say the system's not working, I don't mean like democracy is not the system. I just mean it's like, you know, we have a sports team and nobody is playing their position properly, but has really strong opinions about how everyone else is doing.
It's not exactly the same. Our system of government here is different. We have the Westminster system here in Australia, but there are similarities. There are definitely similarities between what our democracy in Australia has become, and to the point where our media, we don't have a right to freedom of speech as you do in America and North America. And, you know, there are enormous threats against the press freedoms in this country around reporting, particularly around things like refugees, around climate change, around dollars, around, you know, lobbyists and mining companies and things like that. And it's frightening, to be honest.
Sure.
And to the point where, as well, they're making forms of protest illegal.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. I know, right? But, you know, hey, fucking throw another shrimp on the barbie, mate. Everything's sweet, mate. Don't even worry about it, Ryan. No.
Well, look, like, I know less about Australian politics, but I think Brexit's a great example when we talk about people not doing their job. The idea that the whole point of none of these countries being sort of pure democracies is to prevent nightmares like Brexit, which is the people just give you a general policy, right? And say, this is like what Cameron did, where he throws like, hey, should we stay in the EU or not, to the people, was a complete abdication of his responsibilities and for Parliament as well. And now, so what happened was he was like, hey, should we stay or should we go? And people were like, go. And then, you know, now tasked with essentially an impossible task, people are frantically figuring out how to try to do it. That's just not how it's supposed to go. And, you know, I think we're seeing different versions of this in different countries. And then the people take to the streets, or people check out. It's like, it's just a disaster on all ends. I guess the final thing I would say is, also, though, historically, if you really study history and if you sort of study the kinds of things I write about in Stoicism, is you zoom out far enough and you go, none of this really matters. Like, it's gonna go where it's gonna go. People have been fighting and arguing and thinking that the system is tearing itself apart for basically all of recorded human history, and to get too worried or too worked up or to be too anxious about it is to, one, assign too much importance to it, but two, to believe you have more control over it than you actually do. So that's the other thing, is that even with what I'm saying, day to day, this affects my reality almost not at all. So I try to just focus on like, hey, am I being nice to the person sitting next to me on the train? You know, am I being a good neighbor? Am I picking up trash when I see it on the side of the road? Am I being a good husband? Am I being a good father? Am I focused my energy on being good at my job? You know, that's ultimately what I think the historical perspective gives you is like, okay, it's been going on like this for a long time. It's going to go on like this for a long time. Let's try to calm down a little bit.
We have only been talking for a little while, maybe 13, 14 minutes, but already like I am aware of that we have kind of fallen into something that you have talked about in the book, Stillness is the Key, the CNN effect, by just blathering on about stuff that's confronting for so long. People just go,
Totally.
It's an interesting thing to, you know, to have a psychological effect named after a television channel. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah. So the CNN effect is what they found was popping up right around the time CNN comes onto the scene, which is that world leaders used to have a lot more time to think about what they were doing and a lot less real-time information, and that the glut of this has sort of created a not just a paralysis, but a focus on very short-term things. So I talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis a lot in the book. Just the idea that the Cuban Missile Crisis happened over 13 days almost feels like an anachronism, right? If missiles showed up on Cuba again tomorrow, or you know, if North Korea put them on some island close to the U.S., would we give the president 13 days to figure that out? And when you really study it, just how necessary every minute of those 13 days was. We're way too short term. We're way too immediate. We don't create time and space to untangle things and think about them. I gave a talk today at Google and I was showing them this sort of ESPN graphic. It's like, this was from a couple of days ago. ESPN was saying, like, it was a discussion. It was like, who will win the game tonight? And it's like, this is what the news is most of the time. It's not like, hey, let me give you these facts that might, you know, pertain to your decisions. It's more like opinions about facts or speculation about facts. And so the problem is we're just inundated with information. We don't do a good job managing our inputs, and we're bad at really understanding how this glut of information creates fatigue and creates sort of a paralysis that makes for either poor decisions or very emotional decisions in situations that we really want good decisions and unemotional, rational decisions to be made.
Are you saying that the urgency of my phone pinging at me with, you know, something that I follow on Pinterest, a hashtag on Instagram, this news update, that email from an online, you know, retailer that I bought a t-shirt from a year ago, happening every 12 seconds, demanding that I respond immediately? Are you saying these things are affecting my ability to make decisions?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. And I mean, that's like, so when I'm talking about stillness, I want people to understand I'm talking about this not like, oh, you should go meditate or go on a 30-day silent retreat. I'm saying like, let's start very small. Let's turn off all these alerts. Like, why are we giving people, like, to be interrupted by something, that's an incredibly valuable privilege, right? The access to go like, hey, whoever you are, I have something you need to know. That is an immensely valuable privilege. And we turn this over to companies whose sole job it is to get your attention and sell it to other people for advertising dollars. So we shouldn't be surprised that, you know, Words with Friends is updating you, or that Instagram is updating you, or that Facebook is updating you. I mean, like, I love it where it's like, breaking news, cold snap hits East Coast of the United States. And it's like, wait, I don't even live in the East Coast. Why am I getting this information? And, you know, the East Coast of the United States is literally thousands of miles. Like, the amount of people that you have hit with this alert for information that only affects a small percentage of them is ridiculous. And so just deciding to go like, hey, I'm going to decide who I give access to my brain to is a huge step forward in terms of getting clarity and simplicity in your life.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot of the work that you've done after Confessions of a Media Manipulator, a lot of the work has centered around Stoicism. You've mentioned it already. What was it that first drew you towards Stoicism, Ryan?
Yeah, the order that I wrote the books in is sort of unrepresentative in that, you know, I was introduced to Stoicism before I did anything in marketing. I was introduced to Stoicism when I was probably 18 or 19 years old. I was in college and I went to this conference and I asked the speaker for a book recommendation and he turned me on to Stoicism. Now, it took a while for these ideas to really penetrate and sort of become what I built my life around, but it was precisely Stoicism that I was sort of grasping towards as I was stuck in this kind of deeply unethical, confusing, tempting profession. And as I was trying to manage all the inputs that were thrown at me and being successful early and trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life, to me, Stoicism is kind of like a set of principles that you live by. And so I feel lucky to have learned it early. I feel like I had a sort of an intervening career before I really focused on writing about it. But it's sort of been the philosophy I've tried to live almost my entire adult life by.
And it seems that every day, every week, another book comes out that aims to help us deal with modern life. Yet from reading your books, it seems that everything that we need to know was already been thought about thousands of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, look, in Ecclesiastes, they say there's sort of nothing new under the sun. Marcus Aurelius is not a big fan of the Christians, but he said the exact same thing. It's like history is the same thing happening over and over again. It's people fighting over money, trying to get famous, trying to get somebody to sleep with them, trying to have a nice, happy life. Like, as long as humans have been being humans, or as long as humans have lived in cities, let's say, if you don't want to go back too far, you know, we've been struggling with the same problems. I mean, different technological trends in different environments highlight different parts of that experience. But, you know, whether it's a country that's at war or a country that's experiencing a crisis or it's a country that's, you know, sort of become fat and lazy and spoiled, history is more or less the same thing. And the people are going through the same things. And that's what's so interesting to me is, like, as interested as I am in Stoicism and as much as I write about it, I'm always humbled by and but also kind of intrigued at just how similar Stoicism and Buddhism is, right? It's right. Like, oh, there's not only nothing new in the sense that the ancient world had this figured out already, but it's like different parts of the ancient world figured the same thing out in different ways.
And that's the thing that kind of fascinates me. Like, we've just had a baby. We've got an older one. She's nearly 16. We've just had a baby. He's 10 weeks old this week.
Oh, man. Whatever phase you're, like, you have a 10-week-old, that craziness, it's like you could have complained to Marcus Aurelius about that craziness and he'd be like, Oh, my God, it's so hard. You know, like nothing about the experience is the childbirth is fundamentally the same. Raising kids is fundamentally the same. As much as things have changed, it's like people are people and problems are problems.
Well, exactly. And that he came out knowing how to digest food and turn it into poo. He came out knowing how to breastfeed. He came out with a walk reflex. You know, we come out with this source code embedded into us. And I wonder your thoughts on this. You know, do you think that with these different views of the world, Stoics, the Buddhists, the Christians, the Torah, the Talmud, all these places, you know, finding similar ways to describe human behavior, do you think they're just reverse engineering what we are inherently born with and how we inherently behave?
I guess that does go to that sort of fundamental debate about whether we're blank slates or not. But the way I kind of think about it, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, it's kind of like convergent evolution, where there are these sort of species all over the planet that have evolved very similar ways of talking or of doing very similar things. So like bats and birds both fly, but they don't come from the same ancestor. I mean, they all share a common ancestor at some point, but like birds and bats are not like descended from very similar things. They fly in totally different ways, right?
Right.
Pandas and apes both have opposable thumbs, but they're very different. And so I kind of think it's that way with philosophy, where it's like different people at different places in the world, you know, from different traditions can look and feel like they're talking fundamentally differently. But when you kind of look at like what enlightenment is across, whether it's Christianity or Confucianism or Stoicism or Buddhism or Epicureanism or Hinduism or Islam, enlightenment or the highest stage of any of those schools or religions, it's essentially like a really calm, wise person who isn't afraid of anything, who doesn't get riled up, who sort of knows what really matters, who's able to laugh at themselves, who's able to see the big picture, you know, who has some level of sort of moral principle that goes sort of the bedrock of how they behave. Usually they have some sort of, they have both moral and physical courage, you know, like it's the same person, right? And so like at the core of Stoicism is these sort of four virtues: courage, wisdom, justice, and temperance. So like moderation. It's like very hard to find a school that's like courage is bad, you know, wisdom is not important. Definitely, who cares about moderation? And then like, feel free to treat other people badly. You know, like at the core of it, these are really basic, almost self-evident truths, but they get to them in different ways and they advise pursuing them in different ways, whether it's meditation or journaling or the rational mind or the, you know, the sort of non-thinking. Like there's different ways to get there, but they're fundamentally trying to teach the same thing.
You touched on two things there, which you have spoken about at length, and I know that you practice them yourselves, but why does journaling work? Has there been people that have tried to, Boffin sat down in lab coats and tried to figure this out? Why does journaling work?
Yeah. There is. And it is interesting, like journaling is associated with all sorts of interesting benefits. It's helped in some cases like combat Alzheimer's, or it helps people get through divorce. It helps them deal with traumatic experiences. But really at the core, I think the reason journaling works is that it is a dialogue with oneself, but not in the sort of racing part of your brain. It's able to sort of separate who you are from what you think and look at, like when you're writing your thoughts down in a journal, you have like a foot and a half of distance from your own thoughts. Like, so you can see them and you realize that they're not real. Like you can be like, you can be writing about how you hate this person. And you're like, do I really hate this person? Does this really matter? Like it gives you, I think it gives you some perspective on your own thoughts. I think that's a big part of it. But from the Stoic side, I think the reason that journaling and Stoicism are so intricately related is that for the Stoics, philosophy wasn't a thing that you knew. It was a thing that you practiced and that you were running through on a regular, consistent basis. So instead, like people think philosophy is like, oh, I studied philosophy in college, right? Or I have a PhD in philosophy. To the Romans, philosophy was like how you lived, how you responded to individual situations. And so the act of journaling is something that you are doing. And so I think it goes to the core of what Stoicism is. So Marcus Aurelius's Meditations was not Marcus Aurelius writing down the principles of Stoicism for publication. It was him practicing the principles of Stoicism morning and night privately to himself. And that's why I try to journal myself, is like I want to be actively just sort of talking through and reminding myself and inching my way towards where I want to end up.
It's interesting you mentioned that, you know, putting a foot and a half between yourself and your thoughts. Part of my story, Ryan, is that I actually got quite sick about 5 years ago, actually, when we first got introduced via email. And I was experiencing episodes of psychosis that manifested as paranoid delusions. And I knew enough to write this stuff down. And I knew enough to have a look at it. And even though I could see that it was irrational, even though that I could see that it was just, you know, cataclysmic doom.
Sure.
my brain still couldn't accept that, you know, this thing that I was writing down wasn't a real thing. You know, it was tough. And it's interesting. Journaling's really powerful. I've recently gone back on meds. I was off meds for about a year and a half. And just before I got back on meds, I was journaling right up. It was about 4 weeks before the baby got born. And the page is just full of fear, just full of, you know, I'm still, you know, worried about the same things. But when I look at them now that I've been on meds for about 10 weeks, 12 weeks, I go, oh, yeah, okay, I can see that's irrational.
Sure.
But when I was in it, my brain wasn't healthy enough to make that separation, you know. And I think that's Eckhart Tolle would talk about the pain body and, you know, being able to observe your thoughts or, you know, be able to, you know, be the watcher and be the observer. But when I was ill, I wasn't able to do that. The two things were fused. And it was, I guess I just brought it up to kind of go, oh, yeah, that's the thing I should remember.
Totally. And look, I think the other thing is, like, journaling is not this sort of magical panacea that solves the problems in the moment necessarily.
Yeah.
Right. The fact that you're able to look back at your thoughts, you know, from a couple months ago and go, okay, I was clearly in this place. I couldn't see it at the time. Hopefully that's creating an insight that you'll be able to realize next time you start to feel that way. So it's really a kind of an investment in an ongoing process, right? It's like, oh, okay, I can look through my journals. I don't do it a ton, but it's like you can go back through because I kind of remember them. But it's like, oh, these are patterns. This is a spiral that I get myself into. This is a thing I do to myself. And I have the ability to not do that if I so choose.
Looking back at history and studying the patterns, Ryan?
Yeah, studying your own life. Yeah, absolutely.
Throughout your work, you did talk about limiting inputs. And for someone who's worked in the media, the rapid, fast, you know, cycle of media for nearly 10 years or more now, how the fuck do you do it, man? Because you've got kids, you've got this book business, you do speaking gigs, you write books, you help other people get their books up the charts. How on earth does someone as busy as you do this? How do you find time for stillness?
I build my life around it, right? Like this morning, I got up early and the first thing I was doing was writing. It was not touching my phone. It was not checking my email. It was the writing that I had to do for the day. And I had a very short to-do list of about 6 things that I had to accomplish. So I did the writing. Then my son woke up. We went outside. We took a long walk together. So we sort of got in the right. I got in the right headspace. I, you know, experienced some nature. Then I came back. I did my journals, and then I went back into my writing. And I had 2 things on my calendar today. I had a talk I had to give, and I had this thing with you. So part of it is, as busy as it is, I'm also very deliberate about what I say yes to and what I say no to. And I try not to overcommit. I try to control my schedule. And I know that when I agree to things, I'm taking time away from the thing that matters, which is like doing the writing that I want to do. So I'm very intentional. I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm saying no to. And I also know the bad habits that I try to avoid, you know, whether it's watching a lot of the news or gossiping about other people, or I try to be very contained about, even though I can sort of do whatever I want or set up my life however I want, I try to sort of be very ordered and structured about it all, because it is hard. You're not naturally productive. You have to create systems that allow that productivity to happen.
So say, for example, someone's listening to this, then they're most likely they're on a commute. They're like, that's all well and good for you, holiday. You live on a farm outside. You've deliberately taken yourself outside of a metropolitan city. So you're limiting your inputs of who could drop around for a start. Your bandwidth for your internet is lower, so you can't be streaming video left and right. If someone has got themselves into a routine, but their routine just relies on being reactionary to their phone, to the urgency of their kid's got to go to swimming, this one's got to go to dancing, I've got to get dinner on, I've got to get something out of the freezer for dinner later on, I've got no fucking time to sit down and write my thoughts down, holiday.
Sure.
Now, what would you say to someone as the first thing they can start to work on to unravel their day and try to find that stillness?
Yeah. So first off, what I would say is, like, these aren't like accidental things that then allow me to have stillness. Like, I chose to live here in this city in this way because I was prioritizing it. And as much as you might think like, oh, that's a very privileged thing to do, well, it also cost a lot, right? Like I gave up a lot of things to do that. It wasn't free. I'd make more money and be more plugged in and probably sell more books if I lived in New York City or Los Angeles, right? Because I'd have access to things. But those things would also have access to me. So it's about really deciding what you want and how you want to live your life. One essay I would urge everyone to read, Paul Graham has an essay called Maker versus Manager. And he's like, you got to figure out, are you a maker or are you a manager? Like, what do you do? And if you're a manager, then yeah, your day is mostly going to be meetings and phone calls and, you know, checking in on stuff. But the reality is a lot of people are makers, whether they think of themselves that way or not. You know, they're a programmer or they're a physical trainer or they're a podcaster or they're a screenwriter or they're a movie producer or, you know, or they're a hedge fund trader, right? Your job is to make things, to create insights and then to take actions based on those insights in a way that creates value. And you're going to have trouble doing that if you're jerked around, if you're easily distracted, if you don't have routines and structures and systems in place that prioritize the kind of thinking and the kind of stillness that that requires, right? And so it's really important that you make that distinction in your life. But to answer your question about little rules, I would say, like, I didn't touch my phone for the first 2.5 hours that I was awake this morning. That's not to say, oh, it's so wonderful to be me. You were disconnected for the... No, I was working. But what I don't do is start my day from a reactive place. So what Donald Trump tweeted while I was asleep for those 2 hours, you know, while I was checked out, you know, the night and those 2.5 hours, I had no idea. But I did know that the night before I went to bed going, okay, the first thing I have to do is knock this, you know, article out. Or if I was a hedge fund trader, maybe it was like, I got to read these 10 public filings, or I got to make this chart. Or, you know, if you were a professional athlete, you're like, hey, I got to do this workout. I don't touch the phone in the morning. I go right into the main thing of the day, having gotten myself in a headspace that is conducive to doing that thing at an elite level.
You're not the first person to have talked about that on this show, that, you know, if the first thing that you touch in the morning isn't your lover or your one of your children, then something's up.
Totally.
Like if you touch your phone before you touch the people you live with.
Yeah. And how is that success? Like, yeah. You know what I mean? That's the way I think about it. Like, if success is becoming a slave to my calendar, like, I'd rather not be successful, right?
Yeah.
Like, to me, I define success primarily as autonomy. Like, do I get to do what I want to do the way I want to do it, right? And so this helps me decide what opportunities to say yes to and no to. Like, if, you know, I agree to do this thing, and now all of a sudden I found that some person's bossing me around, I'm like, well, you know, fuck this. Like, this isn't what I signed up for. You know, like, so I kind of think about, like, how do I want my life to be? And I sort of judge the opportunities that I see along those lines.
You talked a little bit before about slowing down and just giving yourself time to make decisions. And in the book, you illustrate this through, as we spoke about before, the Cuban Missile Crisis, which really was the world's going to fucking end any second now. I don't think people listening now in 2019 can quite comprehend how knife edge close we were to utter nuclear annihilation. There would have been nothing left of most of the Northern Hemisphere. And then the rest of the world would have had to figure out how to make food for the next 100 years, because the nuclear winter would have been long. We may not all be dealing with Khrushchev as JFK, but how can we, when we're people are pushing us for decisions and pushing us for, you know, how can we not get caught up in urgency? How can we slow things down? How can we hit the slow-mo button on life to give ourselves more time to think about stuff?
I think that's the ultimate question, right? Most of us are not staring across the ocean at a nuclear power, you know, that's acting aggressively, but we are finalizing a divorce or we're negotiating the purchase of a piece of property, or we're trying to deal with a department head, you know, at the company that we created that's being really difficult. And what we need to do in those situations is think about it the way Kennedy did, which was sort of calmly, which was rationally, which is with a lot of empathy. You know, he says, like, his advisors are like, this is an unprovoked act of regression. We need to blow Cuba off the map. And Kennedy's like, whoa, first off, what are people going to think if we do that? Like, how is the world going to react? Is everyone going to understand where we're coming from, or are we going to look like the bad guy? And they're like, well, you know, that's a good point. And then he goes, how are the Russians going to react? Well, you know, they'll probably do this. And he's like, well, that would be really bad, you know? And then he says, why do you think the Russians did this? And they were like, well, because they're Russians, you know? And he's like, no, obviously the Russians were trying to accomplish something, or they had some logic that made them think this would work. And he's like, we got to think about why they did that. And the point being, if you could understand where they're coming from, you could then take actions that would, you know, still force them to withdraw the missiles. There's no sort of negotiation on that as far as Kennedy was concerned. But he was like, how can I make it clear that they have to do that in a way that doesn't make them hit the big button on their desk that blows up the world? And so Kennedy realizes, oh, okay, look, the Russians are testing us. The Russians didn't think this was going to work. They kind of hoped that it would, but they knew it was a gamble, and they were actually making this gamble from a place of desperation. And so if we respond aggressively here, and if we respond without a great deal of care, we might end up provoking something that they really have no intention of provoking, right?
Yeah.
And so he sort of manages to slow things down, to think about it. He gives the Russians a chance to think about it. And I think that's really what you see happen. It's like 5 or 6 days in, Khrushchev's like, oh yeah, maybe this wasn't a good idea, you know? And then they begin to make signs that they're willing to negotiate. And so Kennedy's real brilliance there was sort of the attitude and the approach and the clarity that he brought to the situation. And I think it's hard to find many situations that don't benefit from something like that. Like, very few divorces would be, you know, sort of better negotiated if both parties were more irrationally angry at the other side, right? You know, very few business negotiations would go better if they were more emotional, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the attitude. We want to cultivate that stillness because the stakes are high. They're not nuclear holocaust high, but they are high, and we do benefit from clarity and empathy and deliberateness.
The description of JFK being in the White House in a room full of people with brass all over their shoulders shouting at him to go for it, you know, let's nuke them till they glow, let's bomb them back to the Stone Age. And he's like, give me 1 second, I'm just going to go outside and look at the flowers.
Yeah.
And he literally, like, leaves the room of all these, you know, people thumping their desks on a big, beautiful wooden table and goes and stares at the roses for a while. That blows my mind.
Yeah, he goes swimming. You can see even the notes that he took. You know, you can imagine someone's like, we got to, you know, blow this shit out of Russia. Like, this is our chance. And Kennedy is drawing a picture of a sailboat on his notepad. It's not that he's not paying attention. He is paying attention. But the point is, he's not writing, what's history going to think of me? Are they going to like me? How are we going to do in the elections? You know, like, how could Khrushchev have lied to me? He's trying to slow all of that down because he knows it's not helpful.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to remember that even in that moment, you know, while our adrenaline's firing, while our heart's beating out of our chest, while we're trying to keep the people in the room that want a decision out of us on side, it's super important for us to go, hang on, I'm just going to be reactionary if I move here. What's outside look like right now? What's the air smell like? What do my feet feel like in my socks? You know,
yeah.
Super, super, super important. It was great to hear you talk about taking a walk with your son this morning and getting a little forest bath in. in the morning time. You speak in the book, Stillness is the Key, about getting in commune with nature. We do in our modern ways of life. I mean, I'm sitting in a four-walled concrete box speaking into a metal microphone made in Germany down an internet line. You know, I am doing everything I sure. can to isolate myself from the environment that I evolved in. What eventually happens if we don't actually get out and hug a tree once in a while, and why is it important to do so?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah, we live these sort of deeply unnatural existences, and then we wonder why we feel so unnaturally unhappy or distressed or worried. And you have to go out, and you have to be outside, you have to be with other people, you have to find things that you get sort of core fundamental pleasures from. Like, I know it's not politically correct, but like something like hunting, like being out in the woods, engaging in some primal activity that human beings have been finding meaning and satisfaction in for hundreds of thousands of years is deeply refreshing. So look, if you don't want to hunt, maybe you go fishing. If you're opposed to fishing, go make something out of wood. You know what I mean? Or paint a painting. Like you think about cave paintings. This is tens of thousands of years ago. Human beings were just doing art for art's sake. And the idea that we're going to be 100% focused on our work, or, you know, we're going to be, you know, 100%, where all our free time is going to be spent watching television or playing games on our phone, no wonder we're going to feel way out of balance and unhappy. We're not living the way that we're supposed to be living.
Can you get that kind? I mean, 50% of the world's population live in cities. The access to the outdoors, the access to actual nature, not a landscaped park,
sure.
like is quite difficult and economically prohibitive for many people. How can you access this when you live so far away from it?
Yeah, there's parks. I mean, you can go for a run, you can go for a swim. You know, there's something, like I just went for a swim here in Austin. It was free. I swam at Barton Springs. The only other city that I think has swimming that tops Austin, Texas is Sydney. But the idea of like being underwater, or the endorphins of exercise, or sitting in front of a fireplace, you know, like, or a campfire, right? Like there's so many of these things you can get it from that I think are deeply important. But like, you can also get it in an art museum. You know, you can also get it visiting whatever the oldest historical ruins or sort of military fortification of your city is. Like there's so many places that you can go and get connected to something sort of distant or beautiful or sort of historical. So I don't know. Maybe I don't totally buy the excuse that it's hard. I think it's probably never been easier, because we do have the ability to travel in a way that people were not able to thousands of years ago. And look, it, as modern as this problem feels, I have a quote from Blaise Pascal at the beginning of the book where he says, like, all of humanity's problems stem from our inability to sit quietly in a room alone. So we've struggled with this for a long time. It was a lot easier for, you know, a guy in France in the 1500s to go outside and experience nature. But he's saying, like, still that stillness was difficult to access.
Yeah. When you speak about you're getting outside and being around other people, as someone who has been quite sick in the past, yeah. People were the most terrifying fucking thing there was, man. I didn't want to see people. You know, I pulled my trucker hat down and looked at other people's feet so I could walk through the grocery store. You know, it was the worst. Is it something about just connecting with something bigger than you, realizing and getting your brain to understand that there are other people around, that this is bigger than me, that I am but a small, tiny thing on this massive ball of dirt and water flying through space?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a reason that when we want to inflict real sort of pressure or punishment on inmates, we put them in solitary confinement, right? Like, so, and I say this as an introverted person who's like, nightmare is being at a party for more than an hour or two. You still, no man or woman is an island, right? This is like that being an island is a form of torture that, you know, we're increasingly seeing as barbaric. And yet, people inflict this on themselves, or they make lifestyle decisions that sort of guarantee that's how they are going to be and how they're going to end up. So, yeah, I'm not saying I totally get that some people have social anxiety and there's all these different things. I guess what I'm saying, though, is like you got to feel connected to a larger whole or life, I think, very quickly feels like it's losing meaning.
When you are, but I guess we now live in a world where you could live alone. you could just get in this country, get Deliveroo, which is a nice, you know, Brazilian on a scooter bringing you food from a takeout shop, and never actually speak to anyone in your own community. If you live in an apartment like I do, you know, like, there's 9 other families that live here, and like never actually speak to any of them, not even look at them in the hallway if you wanted, and yet have a community online that you can interact with. And you know, that has over the last 10 years or so been, you know, becoming more of an issue. And that community online is one that does not operate within social norms and the way you can walk around the street and basically, you know, you just be an asshole basically online. And that those communities can go from, you know, certain subreddits or Facebook groups and go all the way to 4chan, all the way to 8chan. And you may, you know, you may feel isolated from the suburb you live in, but accepted and loved and maybe even a leader and a lord and an overlord and a moderator in some of these places. You know, does that serve the same purpose? Do people feel the same sense of connection when they're in these groups of, you know, I guess hate, to be so bold?
No, I think that's actually the problem. I think that's what these groups sometimes deliberately and sometimes unintentionally end up encouraging, is that because these people don't have jobs, because they don't take care of themselves, because they don't have thriving real world relationships, they become much more susceptible to the groupthink or the really bad logic or the obvious. It's why they lack the ability to see that the emperor has no clothes, because they're sort of functioning as a shell of a human being. Like, I feel like you could probably, you know, in America, we have this sort of, you know, extreme right wing radicalization happening. And what you see is most of these people are, you know, sort of bad with the opposite sex, or they're very suppressed about their attraction to the same sex, which is totally fine. But the point is, they're not having thriving romantic relationships. They usually did not do particularly well in school. So they're susceptible to sort of like shoddy logic and bad thinking or bad history. They don't have a good job, right? They don't have any kind of mastery in their life, even of like hobbies. And so, you know, when someone introduces them to sort of like this white supremacy stuff or this sort of incel stuff or these sort of weird manifestos, it's like all their defenses are down and they're very susceptible to it. A person with a girlfriend and a job at the local power plant, there's a reason that these white supremacy groups are not filled with white women who have 3 children, right? Because she's busy and she has meaning and fulfillment in her life. Even if she's stressed to her gills, you know, she's struggling to make ends meet and has a lot to be angry about at society. You know, she's not spending hours on end in a freaking forum railing about immigrants. She's got like shit going on.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. And I was really touched when I was reading in Stillness is the Key, when I was really touched about you talking about, I'm going to pronounce it wrongly, Mitfreude. Is that the German, the opposite of Schadenfreude? I didn't know. I only know Schadenfreude from the Avenue Q song, which is brilliant. But I didn't know that there was an opposite. And I'm wondering, like, if we get 8chan to just do a whole thing about Mitfreude, like to be grateful for the joys of others, would that change the world?
I don't know how to fix them. But what I would think about as a society is, like, we've got to start going, oh, these are deeply pained, broken, but redeemable individuals. Like, look, there obviously are a certain percentage of them that are so radicalized they belong in jail, just like they're, you know, radical Islamists who deserve to be in jail because they can't be saved. But the vast majority of these people are just people who life has kicked around a bunch of times or have made bad choices, and now they're in this deeply vulnerable, deeply sad, almost deeply nihilistic place. And you're not going to get them out of that place by yelling at them and hating them and dunking on them the way we do now on social media. You're going to, you know, we use this word normalization, like we don't want to normalize it. Well, actually, that's what we want to do. We want to normalize these people. We want to reintegrate them into civil society, not have them be angry, you know, connected loners on the internet who are like giving each other ideas for how to hurt as many people as possible. We want sort of help them heal that pain. And like I'm saying this, it's not like I have an active plan. It's not like I've been doing anything about it. But when I think about it, that's what You know, I'll give you an example. I was walking down the street, and Austin has this major homelessness problem. And I've complained about it. Other people complain about it. Like, everyone knows. And I saw this woman. She was wearing yoga pants. She's dressed up very nicely. She dropped off food for this homeless person. And, like, that's nice. Every once in a while, I do something like that. Or, you know, you give money. You really shouldn't. You're really sort of facilitating the lifestyle. But what I thought was fundamentally different, what caught my eye, is she reached down and she patted this person on the shoulder. Like, she squeezed the man on the shoulder. And again, I'm speculating, but I imagine this guy hasn't been touched by a non-other homeless person in quite some time, right? Because he's sort of an other, and he's sort of gross, and he's sort of been cast out from society. Even though he's surrounded by people, he's sort of not. He's not one of us, right? Mm. And I was just sort of deeply touched by this gesture. And what I'm saying is sort of we need that analogous gesture. I think that's the only way you're going to solve a lot of these sort of radicalization problems we're facing now.
Is to try to see the human behind what is going on and try to understand, as you mentioned with Khrushchev's, like, why are they like this? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It does require you to put your own, you know, fortifications of righteous anger away, because that does make me feel safe, Ryan.
Sure.
You're obviously a guy that thinks a lot about the world. You're a very busy guy, and you do expose yourself at points to, you know, finding ways, you know, which directions the world is heading, and you've got little kids. How do you juggle the things that history shows you might be next versus the world that you can see your kids growing into and what you can do about it, man?
Yeah, mostly I just try to be present, you know. I try to focus on what's in front of me, because, like, yeah, sure, I do have concerns about the world that, you know, my kids are going to be in and their kids are going to be in, or that I'm going to be in 50 years. But I also know that's no guarantee. And so I'm not going to neglect this sort of moment in front of me in exchange for sort of worrying about something. I want to take active steps. You know, it's like when I'm walking down the street, I see a piece of trash, I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to sort of vote for the people I'm going to try to vote to. I want to support the causes that I think are important. I want to write about the ideas that I think people are better off for knowing. But, you know, I think climate change is a great example where, I agree it's a problem, and I agree we're not doing enough about it. But you see certain people have just sort of, it's almost like that's become where they're able to project all their sort of general anxiety and frustrations and fears at. Mm. And it's almost become this thing that's, like, consumed their existence. And look, there are definitely people who are activists about it, and that's, like, their profession, so that makes sense. But I'm just saying, like, if your 16-year-old is waking up and talking about climate change constantly, like, chances are, like, that has nothing to do with climate change and a lot more to do with a skewed perspective of priorities.
You're talking my language, Ryan. As someone who has been that 16-year-old, but as a 40-year-old, I get it. I absolutely get it. I'm really loving when you post it comes out the last thing at night, right before I go to bed. I'm loving Daily Dad.
Oh, thank you.
Which is an email, you know, of the gajillion emails that you write. What drove you to want to talk about fatherhood and want to talk about being a father and try to find resources and reflections on fatherhood?
Yeah, well, no, it's funny. So it's dailydad.com. It's a free email every day. It's funny. It actually goes out in the morning in the U.S., but for whatever reason, we can't figure out how to, like, time it for different countries.
Oh, mate, I love going to bed with it. I love it.
Well, that's perfect. I wrote it. My thinking is, like, you want this to guide your day, but for you, you're sort of concluding the day. So it's awesome that you like it. What I found is that I just found, like, all the parenting books. And there's some good ones out there. There's definitely some bad ones. But the problem is they treat it as this thing that you read, like, one time and then you got it. Like, it's even like What to Expect When You're Expecting. It's like you read it, but it doesn't take you 9 months to read. So you're either reading about things that have already happened or you're reading about things that haven't happened yet, right? It's like you're not reading it on an ongoing basis. And so I wanted to make Daily Dad something that's like, here, let me give you a thought sort of guided by ancient wisdom or a story that illustrates a psychological principle or a sort of basic parenting insight. Let me just give that to you every day. So it's something that you're doing every day, and it's something that you can get value out of whether you have a 10-week-old or a 40-year-old. Because that's the other interesting thing about parenting is that you never stop being one. Like, it's an ongoing thing, and you're always facing sort of new challenges or new difficulties. So I just felt like it was a hole in the market that if it existed and I could subscribe to it, I would have done that, but it didn't. And so we made it, and it's been really cool. It's one of my favorite things to write every day.
Oh, mate, I'm loving it. Not just because I've been a stepfather now for, that's one thing. Hey, Ryan, how about some more stepfather stuff?
that's a good point.
Yeah.
You're right. I'm on it.
So my stepdaughter was 10 when I showed up. And what was interesting is that I started being more kind of full time, and I moved in when she was just about 11. So I had an 11-year-old stepdaughter with exactly 1 year of parenting experience,
right.
Dealing with the perils of an 11-year-old challenging me. It was tough, man, and it was definitely interesting, and I learned a lot about myself. But similarly, when my wife and I were on this journey of welcoming a baby into the world, the last year of our lives, I was looking for dad stuff, and all I could really find, all the books were aimed at women.
Totally.
All the dad stuff was very, very kind of nuts and bolts, a lot of physics, a lot of, names of hormones, a lot of really kind of tactile, is going to happen for this long, and then it'll do that, and then it'll be over. You're like real, like, dude stuff, like facts, But there was a dearth of like, well, what do I do with these feelings,
Yeah.
And so interestingly, like my mate Charlie, he's another podcaster here in Australia. He was having a baby a couple of weeks out, and we just started this podcast. And I thought there'd be shitloads of dad podcasts. There's us. There's like
no, there's none.
That
there's
many none, parenting really podcasts, but there's just like one done by dads. It's me and Charlie.
It is very interesting. And a lot of the dad stuff too is also very like condescending. It's like an idiot's guide to being a dad, how to not fuck up your kids. And it's like, well, I'd like to do slightly better than just not fucking them up.
So you've got a few kids of your own. If you could have anything that you would pass on to me, Ryan, what have you got?
Yeah, I won't condescend to you because I don't know. I only know a little bit about the second problem. I don't know anything about talking to a 16-year-old. At the core of Stoicism are these sort of four virtues we were talking about, sort of courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance. And at the core of those virtues, to me, is like the solution to all or any problems, right? Like one of those virtues is the solution to each problem, right? That's sort of how I've come to think about it. Obviously, there's different ways of communicating it, and there's sort of different definitions of, is the courageous thing to stand up? Is the courageous thing to keep going? It could be either, is the courageous thing to walk away, or is the courageous thing to stay in it, even though everyone's, attacking you for it? Is the right thing to be kind, or is the right thing to be firm? Is the right thing to forgive, or is the right thing to think, to insist on justice, even though it makes you uncomfortable? There's plenty of room inside each one of those things. But when my wife and I sort of think about what values we want to teach our kids, like, those are the four we're going to be building everything around and on top of.
Mate, that is extraordinarily powerful advice. I like it very much. It's simple. It's something I can write on the fridge. I like it when it's I could talk to you all day. I appreciate very much that you've chosen to do this with your precious hours of your time. Ryan, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, man. Thank you so, so much, mate.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate it. I'm glad we finally got to do it.
You got it, man. Have a cracking day, man.
Thanks. You too.
That was Ryan Holiday. You can find him online, ryanholiday.net, or you can check him on Twitter. He's Ryan Holiday, or Instagram. He's also Ryan Holiday. A massive thanks to Manish Sethi and Pete Williams for the years-long networking magic they pulled to get me into Ryan's calendar, which was a feat. And also Rachel Barrett, my brilliant manager and producer of this show, who got me and Ryan in front of laptops at the same time on other sides of the planet. It was quite a remarkable thing that she did there. Big thanks to Andy Marr, my audio producer, who made this show.
sound super sweet. And Mike Mills, also known as Toe Hider, who made all the fantastic music. Thanks for listening. That's it. That's it for today. Wherever you are, try and stay safe. Try and look after people that you've never met before. Because that's the only way we're going to get out of this. Well, the only way we're going to get through this, to be honest. There's no getting out of it, is there? We really are all in this together. I'll talk to you on Friday. Your ace. Have a cracking week. Until we speak next time, sleep well and dream of beautiful things.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.